morning. No, I didn't say good morning. I said this morning. Good morning, anyway. Right. I'm not going to talk until you do. I spent 2 days raising some questions about public policy toward labor unions and suggesting some consequences of this policy. And I'm sure that you must have some speeches to make, some questions to ask, some suggestions to present, and that's what we're going to do today. And when you run out, well, then Vern is ready, he can start in. If he's not ready, we can all go out and play volleyball. So, the floor is open. The subject is labor unions, in some fashion. Just sort of try to keep the discussion around labor unions. Yeah.
In terms of these international labor unions, what we're talking about, you make some comment about the Kohler case.
The Kohler case. Yeah. Well, this was a case, I don't know whether you're familiar with it, the Kohler Company in Wisconsin near Sheboygan is a family-owned corporation, and the big cheese is a guy named Herbert Kohler, whose brother, wasn't it? Or was it? No, his nephew was governor of Wisconsin for a while, just recently. Well, now, about, 12 years ago now it was, wasn't it? Somebody, you were nodding your head there. It was a long time ago. His plant, which manufactures plumbing fixtures, you know, bathtubs, toilets, stuff like that. His plant had been non-union, and the United Automobile Workers decided to organize his employees. And he was running a very benevolent despotism. he had a nice company town there, Kohler, Wisconsin. They have Kohler of Kohler. They provided all sorts of goodies for the employees. And I heard Kohler once, and he does strike me as a kind, feudal lord. Is what he wants to be. A very kind one, but still, basically thinks it was a mistake to move out of the Middle Ages. But anyway, the UAW and he didn't get along too well. He didn't like the idea of unions. But the UAW did get a representation election. The majority, but a narrow majority of the employees, wanted the union. So Kohler was stuck. The Wagner Act says that's it. Kohler's got a bargain with him. Well, the first thing the UAW does is demand a union shop contract.
Is it all workers?
Yeah. UAW, United Automobile. Well, this is not plumbing. This is not plumbing. This is manufacture of plumbing equipment, plumbing fixtures. Yeah. Well, you know, of course, that unions don't stick to their jurisdiction. There is no industrial union to organize people who manufacture plumbing equipment. So who's going to do it? Well, the UAW came in, probably at the request of some of the people, because it's a strong union, good organizing staff. Well, there are some, there are members in the United Automobile Workers doing practically everything. That's nothing, though. You know, it's actually the United Automobile, Aircraft, and Agricultural Workers Union. That's the full title. Mine workers, you know, have a District 50, which organizes anybody. District 50 includes brewers, carpenters, spectacle grinders, everything. District 50 is the catch-all. The Teamsters, you know, drive horses. It's the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Chauffeurs, Warehousemen, and Helpers. And they organize anybody.
There are a lot of laboratory workers that belong to this trucking union.
Teamsters, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, this is one of the advantages of it. You can get knocked the employer off a lot of places. Ouch. But anyway, what happened was that Kohler said no, he wouldn't sign a union shop contract, which would mean that all of the employees would have to join the union. And there were probably 40% of them who didn't want to join the union, who didn't want the union in there in the first place. So a strike resulted. The strike was over the union shop. Will Kohler sign a contract that says all employees must join the union? Kohler said no. I gave all the reasons for it. And the union said yes, and they struck. Strike dragged on and on and on. Kohler decided to operate the plant. Well, he had a good number of loyal employees to begin with. He brought them in, and then he just started hiring. Then he replaced all of his striking employees. And now, if there's anything that gets a union man on strike mad, it's having a strike breaker take his job. You've got to understand the emotion, the deep emotion. How would you feel, you know, if you think, you honestly believe that you're striking for the benefit of all the workers? You're out here making a sacrifice. You're doing without your paycheck. And here is some crud taking your job. All right, so you get rocks through windows, bombs, people getting beat up. The town of Kohler is divided against itself. Family members don't speak to each other. Haven't spoken to each other in 10 years. Bitter sort of thing. Drag on and on and on. Both sides filed unfair labor practice charges in this dispute. Both sides were using highly questionable techniques, breaking people's necks and stuff like this. The National Labor Relations Board and the courts upheld certain charges of unfair labor practice against Kohler, contending that Kohler had, in fact, dismissed some of his employees and replaced them for, not because they were striking, but because they were gung-ho union members, and that's an unfair labor practice. And so the UAW took a renewed zeal from this sustaining of this charge, and the thing went on and on. Finally, it got sort of settled about 2 years ago, was that Kohler was ordered to take back those employees who wanted to come back, who had, you know, gone on strike years ago, but most of them, of course, had moved away, and many of them had died. And what finally happened is there's no union shop, and the UAW has been sustained morally by being told it was sort of in the right, but they lost anyway. And it's tremendous bitterness has ensued. It's a horrible example of what can happen when you get ideologues on both sides. The UAW is one of the most ideological of American unions. It's one of the unions where the labor unionism is still seen as a cause, something to believe in. And Kohler looks upon non-unionism as a cause, too. It's something to believe. He travels around the country speaking for spiritual mobilization, which is this outfit that believes that God is a capitalist. And you get these two ideas, and they don't talk to each other. They can bargain collectively, but the NLRB said Kohler had refused to bargain, violation of Wagner Act Section 8A5. And he really had refused to bargain. Kohler's idea of bargaining was to sit sort of on his throne and wonder why the peasants are restless tonight.
Question.
Yeah.
This is in reference to the fact that you said that when they have a strike, some men get a little better wage, but more men are laid off. That's the background to my question. Do you think that the labor union has caused a type of welfare state here?
Does that second part of your question connect with the first?
Yes. You said in one of your lectures that whenever we have a strike, this is not for the reason that the trouble sets up is that I get a raise on my job, but somebody down the street loses because they don't hire as many men as they used to. That those who are working get a higher wage, but there are more men out of work.
Yeah.
All right. Now, these people that are out of work are having to live, so we are taxed, and they are given a dole, more or less. And my question is, do you think that the reason that we have so many people on the dole is because of labor unions?
I think that labor unions have a good deal to do with it, but that's not by any means the only reason.
No.
Both through pushing wages up in some occupations to untenable levels, pushing wages up so high that employment, especially over a period of years, is radically reduced, and thus people are forced to go find jobs in other sectors of the economy in that way, and by political action through securing a minimum wage. In some of our largest cities, the minimum wage is a disaster. It prevents employers from hiring workers at a wage equal to what the worker is worth to the employer. Now, people say, but every man is worth at least a dollar and a quarter an hour. Well, heavens, in God's eyes, every man is worth a heck of a lot more than a dollar and a quarter an hour. He's worth at least $75 an hour in the eyes of God. The employer isn't God. The employer isn't paying him for his human dignity or his inalienable rights or any other gibberish. He's paying him to produce left-handed monkey wrenches. And if that guy adds to the employer's profits 82 cents for every hour that he works, how can the employer afford to pay him more than that? If he has to, this won't hire him. We saw this happen in New York City under this attack on poverty program. The employers were willing to hire these high school dropouts and young people in the process of training, but they were paying them something like 80 cents an hour. And the unions protested. What? You're violating the minimum wage. How are we going to wipe out poverty when under the government's own poverty program, people are paid a poverty wage? And so Secretary of Labor Wirtz ordered everybody to pay a minimum of a dollar and a quarter. Fantastic. Now, the option is not work for 80 cents or work for a dollar and a quarter. The option is work for 80 cents or don't work at all. If you try to push it up to a dollar and a quarter, most of these people aren't going to get jobs. And that's what's happened. Now, all the employers who said they'd go along, they'd help, they'd put these kids to work, sweeping out the store, you know, or doing some kind of Mickey Mouse, it just isn't worth much. Its marginal productivity is low. They backed out. What have we gained by this? Well, we put the kids back on the streets where they can do something more productive. Knife one another. Look for dope. In these two ways, I would say unions have contributed to the number of people on the dole. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Somebody was talking about that last night. There he is. It was you, wasn't it? Yeah. And I said, well, the price of lettuce is doubled. He said, well, so what? That's about what you said, isn't it? So what? Well, maybe we can all afford to pay twice as much for lettuce. But lettuce isn't the only thing. And there are lots of poor people. I hate to see the price of food going up. Food is fairly basic to many people. A low price for food is important. And why should the price of food go up? I mean, where is the justice with a small j in this whole Bracero program? Oh, boy. I mean, well, look what we've done now. Oh, yeah, I'm going to speak. What the dickens are we doing in this business? You know, now we're not going to let them Mexican workers in. Why? Now, here the argument shifts. You try to pin them down in one place, and they shift. They say, because we've been exploiting Mexican workers. Ah, that's a funny situation. Here you got a Mexican worker who's chomping at the bit to get into this country to work for 75 cents an hour. He's down there now in Mexico tearing his hair and crying his heart out and unemployed, and his family is starving because he's not allowed to come in. And we say, you want to get in here you desperately and work for 75 cents an hour, but we refuse to let you be exploited. How noble of us. Well, we're not, obviously not trying to protect the growers. Who are we trying to protect? Well, we're trying to provide more jobs for Americans. Well, that's very fine. But Americans aren't willing to do stoop labor for 75 cents an hour. You can't get them. They just, well, you can get a few. They won't last. I've worked in these harvest operations, and I've seen Americans work for way. wages higher than that. And we ain't so hot. We're pretty soft. But so the unions come back, and they push this. The liberal labor lobby pushes this sort of stuff. And they say, yeah, well, those growers have to pay a decent wage. What's a decent wage? $1.25 an hour. That's defined as a decent wage. So you pay these guys $1.25 an hour, and you still can't get enough of them. And on top of that now, your labor costs, these people are less efficient. They're being paid about a third more or two-fifths more. They're picking less lettuce and weeding fewer beans and all this sort of stuff. And what's going to happen? Well, these farmers are not operating with some big fat margin. Some of them are, of course. But a lot of these farmers are operating just as close to the line as most businessmen operate. And they're going to have to make some kind of adjustment. One thing they do is let the stuff rot in the field, or make their decision next year not to grow the stuff, or mechanize, find a machine to do it. And then what have we gained? We have, and then all of a sudden, agriculture gets automated in the Imperial Valley. And then people say, labor unions will say, here it is, automation coming in again, destroying more jobs. What are we going to do about it? Of course, they had nothing to do with the automation. It wasn't their fault that automation came in.
What do you propose then that we do with this low segment of our labor force?
I don't propose that we put them to work in the fruit farms or vegetable farms of California. They don't belong there.
All right, what then?
What then? I propose, for one thing, that we put them to work at any wage which they are willing to accept and which employers are willing to pay. I see no justification for a minimum wage, a legal minimum wage. That's one thing.
You have no, it doesn't raise a Christian question with you to bring everybody up to a livable wage. If it means a nickel more for your head of lettuce.
If I felt that a nickel more for my head of lettuce would do the job, I'd be willing to pay a nickel more. I'm not sure I'd be willing to tax everybody else a nickel more. I can afford a nickel more. Some people can't. It isn't just lettuce, you see. If you start this business, and it gets to be a lot of things. And I can afford it, and you can afford it, but many people can't afford it.
I have lettuce to pay on lettuce.
Well, there's a lot less lettuce reached market this year. Tremendous reduction in the supply. Yeah, it's highly perishable, and it's just they just couldn't get it on the market.
May I comment on what this gentleman just said?
Yeah.
It is my opinion that it would be better, instead of raising one person's wage, like I said last night about the Chinese, these are the poorest people in the world, but they're also the cleanest. Well, it's the same way if you've got 1,000 people working for 50 cents an hour, they're getting 50 cents worth of food and key. But if you try to raise their wage and there are thousands of them out of work, they don't have 50 cents worth of food and key. Well, that's not Christianity. In my opinion.
It's not
The Christian way is to give everybody something, not just a few.
Well, this is one question you've got to answer. It's an economic question, not a theological or ethical question. Does a minimum wage law really benefit the poor? An interesting bit of evidence that it does not is that the groups and the political areas pushing hardest for a minimum wage and for increases in the minimum wage are those groups and those political areas where the minimum wage will have almost no effect. A southern economist by the name of Marshall Colburn has argued at length that minimum wage legislation is an attempt by the North to exploit the South. That northern workers, being paid fairly well and almost all above the minimum wage, surely those organized into unions are, have agitated for a higher and higher minimum wage in order to destroy the one advantage that the South has over the North, which is a plentiful and hence cheap supply of labor. That cheap supply of labor attracts capital to the South, which is what the South, as a relatively underdeveloped region needs, more capital. But as capital moves to the south, the demand for labor in the north does not increase as rapidly. So the already relatively well-off northern workers, in an attempt to maintain and increase their advantage over the south, are ramming through Congress legislation to destroy the south's, any advantage the south has. Is this Christian?
Can a man live on 85 cents an hour as he's getting in Texas, or on 69 cents an hour as he's getting in Arkansas?
Yes.
Yes, indeed.
In many circumstances.
I know.
In many circumstances, he can. In our wealthy society, it is, I do not like it that some men get 69 cents an hour. If there are, however, three people in the family and all three of them are working for 69 cents an hour, they can live. I still don't like it. But I want to be sure that when we do something about it, we make the situation better and not worse. Now, passing a minimum wage law, say they must all be paid a dollar and a quarter an hour, may not get them up to a dollar a quarter, may make them all unemployed. Now, if a guy can't live on 69 cents an hour, can he live on nothing?
Well, is it fair to bring in an import labor in order to take, that will take my job away from me?
Well, are you concerned about the Mexicans at all?
Of course, but I'm an American.
Why do you draw the line at the Rio Grande and say, let the Mexicans... Now, there's some real suffering and destitution, some real poor people just over the Rio Grande in northern Mexico. And the Texas and California, it has been a real... I think you could say that it's a kind of judgment you can't make in any scientific way, but the extra happiness that has come to the Mexico from letting the Braceros come over, it far exceeds any extra happiness that can come to the United States from not letting them come.
But at whose expense? This is the issue, I think. It's at the expense of the lowest segment of our labor force.
How? Are those Braceros in competition with the lowest segment of our labor force?
Of course they are. Last year,
when
we had 10,000 Braceros in our valley, they were getting 87 cents an hour, and so was I when I went out to work for a day. This year, when I went out and worked for a day, when the Bracero was not permitted in there, and there was a little competition for the labor that was available, I was able to get $1.40 an hour, and some of the workers who had experience were able to get as much as $2 an hour because they had experience.
And how many workers were there relative to the previous year?
Well, here, of course, your issue that you very successfully and very actively trailing state plays a part. Last year, I think we probably have a total labor force of about 16,000 in our particular area. And I suppose this year, I haven't seen the final figures, but I suppose it's around 9 or 10,000. But last year, 10,000 of those 16,000 were Braceros. 6,000 were from the American labor force. This year, 9,000, we only have 9,000, are from the American labor force. This is still twice or half again as many. From the American labor force are employed in our valley this year as were employed last year. So as far as the American business economy, which it seems to me comes into a very prominent play here, this is a significant factor in the, if you're going to be in an American business, why should you expect a government welfare program, which to me is what the Cicero program is, for the grower, because he's not about to pay me $1.40.
Why do you call it a government welfare program? It's the government has simply removed some, what I would call, artificial restrictions to the free movement of people. I don't think that's a welfare program. If the government pays the cost of getting the Braceros up there and doesn't take it out of the pockets of the growers, then I think that's there's a welfare aspect to it. So the government just simply says, you can hire labor, any labor you want to. We'll let Mexicans come in if you want to hire them, if they're willing to work for you. That's a welfare program. What doesn't? Why? What do you mean? I didn't say anything high-minded.
It's so nice to have the Braceros come in because it's good for them. But it does put someone out of work. And those who have worked before in these areas have left
I do not deny this. There are more job opportunities for WASPs in California this year because of the end of the Becerra program. There are also a lot less jobs for Mexicans. Now, if you can draw your lines at the Rio Grande, all around the United States, and say, we're not interested in anybody outside of the United States. I can't go that route, but I'll do it for purposes of argument. And now we got the next question. This year, there was a 50% increase in the quantity of labor demand. I will bet that will be less next year, and less for next year, and pretty soon we're going to be right back where we were, 6,000 jobs, or probably less. Probably less. They'll be getting more money. They'll be getting $1.40 an hour. But there'll be about 3,000. And in fact, there'll be not just the highly skilled workers. They'll have a big, they'll have cotton picking machines all over the place, or tomato picking machines or something. And there'll be just highly skilled operators, members of the Brotherhood of Operating Engineers, pulling down $4.72 an hour and saying, see what the end of the Bracero program did? It pushed the wage up from 80 cents an hour to 470. And of course, it reduced employment from 1,000 to 15. And in the long run, I would predict, might be wrong, that the price of food will rise, which is hard on the poor, that the amount of labor employed in agriculture will decline, and that the unemployment problem, even for Americans, will be aggravated.
I congratulate you, Mr. Watson. But I will see that your solution of keeping the Becerra is going to do is any better.
Well, I'm not arguing on letting the Becerra be the solution to our poverty problem. Our poverty problem is a very complex thing. You know, at the present time, we talk about the not enough jobs. Well, the number of job vacancies, according to the standard indices of job vacancy, at the present time exceeds the number of the unemployed. But of course, the unemployed don't fit neatly into these job vacancies. Not just lack of training and education. Frequently, it's a matter of lack of knowledge, lack of certain of the right race, racial characteristics or sexual characteristics, or just a geographic location. But there are all sorts of things. Now, I think that one of the most useful attack on this problem, and the trouble is there's nothing dramatic about this. People like a dramatic program. You know, barrels, that's dramatic. It makes a big fuss. People can see something's being done. They can see some immediate effect. A few immediate effects that won't be dramatic at all. It is that we work at the task of making the labor market more perfect. That is to say, we try to increase the information, improve the if possible for people and jobs to get together more quickly. How do you go about this? Well, this takes some expense, how do you get about it? It's a highly technical business, and you go down to some large city, and they'll tell you how they're working at it. But it's a slow thing. But I think in the long run, it's most likely to pay off. Yeah.
You think there's any, our foreign aid program could give a couple of $100 million to the Mexican Becerra plan?
Well, I don't think it's good.
But this is sometimes the way it goes. We cut one group off and then our taxes, we fill their pockets in another way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's confusing for the average American.
Yeah, kind of confusing for everybody. Now, we refuse to engage in trade, exchange, whether of labor or country, and then when they become impoverished, send them to China. Yeah.
Do you think cooperatives can solve anything in our economy today?
Well, cooperatives. They've had a long history in this country, and it's a pretty unspectacular one. My estimate would be no. There's not much to be hoped for from co-ops. I think they've had a chance to see what they can do, and for a number of reasons, maybe that Americans just aren't interested in the idea of cooperative enterprise. Maybe we're too individualistic. And there are other reasons for the failures of co-ops too, though. You know, co-ops have always supposed, not always, usually supposed, that they didn't need good management. They didn't have to pay a price to get top management. And this is a mistake. If you want to run an enterprise, and a co-op is an enterprise, you've got to have somebody running it who knows how to do it. And that means the co-op has to get in there and pay the kind of money that you have to pay in order to get a top flight manager. You can't let the best managers be hired away by uncooperative enterprises. The unwillingness to recognize the necessity for skills, managerial skills, has damaged many co-ops. But of course, some function well in the United States, but you look around, they're run pretty much like other businesses. There's no distinction that makes a difference that you can find between a co-op and another kind of enterprise. They're much more successful, of course, in other countries. England, the Scandinavian countries have had far more success with co-ops, and they've become something of a law for people in parts of England and Scandinavian countries, that it's somehow more moral, more Christian to buy your bread at the co-op. No. There's a big, they call it the co-op, big grocery store near the University of Chicago, where all Democrats shop. Now they have good prices and a tremendous range of food. It's a great store. I go there too when I live in Chicago. But with some of these people, it's just a matter of religion. You shop at the co-op and thereby strike a blow for the new society. Where are those people who wanted to talk about unions, teachers' unions? Aren't they here? Shut my mouth. Who's for union, teachers' union? Who thinks teachers' unions are very important? We got it. Nobody?
What is the purpose?
No, you're for them.
No. It isn't the union as a union, but it's the idea of people getting together for their own mutual benefit. Now, if these people don't get together in any of the professions, say there are a good many professions who actually work for a wage, just like anyone else who worked in a factory, and they sometimes don't get paid enough, what are they going to do? They're supposed to be so high-minded that they cannot get together and say, we need more money. So, where does that leave you?
Well, it leaves you with a union.
You can call it a professional association.
Oh, that's one of these lovely dodges. The American, I have refused to join the American Association of University Professors, and that's one of the reasons that I can't stand a trade union that starts off by saying it isn't a trade union.
Is that the French National Association?
No, the AUP is the Trade Union of College Professors. It's a very ineffective trade union, very bad one. But it comes out, you know, they start off at the beginning, this is a professional association dedicated to raising standards. This is not a trade union, that's what they told you at the first meeting. And I'd open the Brotherhood of Carpenters journal. This is an association dedicated to the raising of standards in the profession, not narrowly concerned with it. So every trade union claims it. Somehow the AUP thinks it ought to be believed. Well, but nothing is gained by calling a trade union a professional association. Let's call them all professional associations, or all trade unions.
Well, in each school district, you have two buying.
Well, you got jurisdictional disputes. You got two trade unions fighting for jurisdiction.
Or, and regular union too, I suppose. I mean, draft unions, and all the teachers' United States. Teacher unions are in Seattle and Spokane, but very little about it. Why is this? Well, I think you are not teaching. I remember it being said, well, fortunately, in the conference. As far as I hear,
and it's largely in the mind of the teacher. And that's why the professional associations have this advantage that they permit the teacher to join with good conscience. The teacher says, I am a professional person dedicated to the welfare of my students. I'm not a unionist. I would not think of exerting economic pressure in order to increase my wages, but I would certainly join with my professional colleagues in order to secure a more equitable or to secure a wage which recognizes the worth and dignity of the teaching profession. I really think this is the difference, but I think it can get us off the question. I'd like to see somebody, some of you teachers argue with her.
Very funny, really.
What?
This is not for me being very funny.
Well, I want to see somebody get back to your point. I want to get back to your point. What do you think?
Is the teacher going out there?
You think the teachers, wait a minute, you think the teachers should be propagandizing them little kitties?
No.
Yes, unions have their own ethical practices code. Can we get back, though, to the question that she raised now? But what do teachers do? You said teachers are being low, they're low paid, they're overworked. And what can they do about it? What's the alternative to teachers? Isn't it true that when you take a job, you decide to take it on the basis not only of the wage, but how much you like it? If you're getting paid a wage below what you're worth, and this is a question, of course, who decides what you're worth? Is any of us capable of deciding what he's worth? But if you keep that job, even though, well, let's say you could get another job for $2,000 a year more out of teaching, but you say, no, I like to teach. So you go to the, can you go to the school board? Could you in good conscience now go to the school board and say, look, you're paying me X dollars. I could get that job over there for X plus 2,000. But I don't take it because I like to teach. I enjoy teaching and I want to work with these kids. So you're exploiting me. You're exploiting my goodwill and my love for teaching. Boost my wage to what I could get over there. Well, maybe you could argue that way, but they could come right back and say, one of the reasons we're paying you so little is because it's such fun to teach. I mean, the psychic income is important, too. I'm not against that strike.
Well, it isn't exactly that I'm not a strike. I've got children at home and I can't go to work. But it would be difficult for me to go back and get started for very little that I couldn't really live on. If I was just paying for myself, it would be all right. But if I had to raise the family,
how much
what I could make.
How much is
hospital administrators, more than they, and they, you know, then they come out with all this moral cant. And I don't misunderstand me. A hospital administrator or a superintendent of schools who reads the lecture about you, professional people, joining a union, I got no use for that sort of malarkey. You see, I don't think it's a moral issue at all. I don't think there's I can't find an iota of genuine moral issue in question of the salary of nurses or teachers or preachers.
Or strawberry
pickers. Well, a little more. I may find some there because you have a real poverty problem somewhere down in here. But teachers today are not poverty stricken, nor are preachers by a long shot. I hear some stories around here about the ALC. I don't know about it, but I suggest some of you preachers might join the Missouri Synod. My experience with wages of pastors in the Missouri Synod has been, what, man, they're going up. It's a matter, wealthy congregations, it's a matter of prestige. They like, the members like to go out and brag about what they're paying the preacher. So they got to kick him up.
Well, we have a significant advantage. As preachers, we've had a district president or a synod president running around with a, and I have these congregations that if you want this man, you can get salary.
Well, you have your secretary. I'm not worried about that.
You know, there's a great shortage of nurses today, and if a hospital administrator complains about the shortage of nurses and refuses to pay a higher wage, I say, forget it, buddy. There's always a shortage if you're not willing to pay enough. And this shortage is going to pull up the wages of nurses or force hospitals to find ways to do without nurses. One or the other, isn't it? And I think that's the only way the wages of nurses are going to rise, if they rise at all.
We could bring in Mexican nurses.
We have brought in a lot of Irish ones. And we have denuded Ireland of its professional nurses.
There are thousands of Negro nurses in the South now. Registered Negro nurses working in the hospital there, and thousands of electric beds where they don't need a nurse to wind it up.
There are lots of ways to economize on nurses. And teachers, too. As we get around it. Suppose, look, you say teachers aren't getting paid enough. Now let's look at the whole problem. The school board's got a certain number of dollars with which it can hire teachers. That means it can hire either so many teachers at this wage or a smaller number of teachers at a higher wage. If it hires a smaller number of teachers, where's it going to put all the kids? So they figure out they got to have this many teachers, they got this many dollars, here's what they can afford to pay. And roughly that's kind of the way things go. Now, you get a wage increase, and the school board's going to have to get more money, that's all. Or else increase the workload of all the teachers, make the classrooms bigger. Is that good? Can the school board get the money? What if the school board just can't get the money? You say, well, the people ought to be willing to pay higher taxes. Why should the people be willing to pay higher taxes? Say, well, because education is a good thing. Of course education is a good thing. That's what we're arguing about. We're arguing whether the teachers ought to be paid more. I can't either. There's always one way, though, you can resolve. If you're a teacher, I mean, if you're somebody who's involved, you can make your own decision about what you're going to do. You can move out of the county, move out of the state, and get a teaching job in an area that pays better. And this has an effect. It does. If a certain state or certain county is real crummy in the pay scale, its teachers are going to leave. And it's going to have to improve. You got a tyrannical superintendent of schools, he's going to find himself with a terrible turnover problem. And the pressure's going to be brought to bear on him. Now, this works, but it's too slow. Most social problems are solved by slow means. And,
well, what's new thing that bothers me is they keep building larger hospitals and larger places, knowing that they can't staff these places. What are they going to do? And every time they raise the prices of the Blue Cross, it's always the nurses' wages that cause it.
No, they don't say that. There's a general increase in overhead. I know. I see these things, and I've never heard of, never seen them mention nurses' wages.
Every raise you get in the hospital are blamed on nurses' wages.
Maybe that's out in California. Where you?
I have a question, please.
Yeah.
Why?
Wait a minute. Why?
Why?
Oh, you mean the living cost? Living cost.
You're actually
living
cost.
Like if you are a dedicated person, whether you're a school teacher or a nurse, you should be willing to decide on the dollar sign.
Yes, I am. I'm
I think that argument you used is not fair.
Let's swing it around the other way. A teacher works about 9 months out of a year, assuming that he's highly educated. Now, say, for example, if I was a field press operator and I made $5,000 a year, I work 12 months out of the year. This teacher works 9 months. She's got 3 months free. Now, either she can go for a master's degree, or she can take extra studies. I'm taking the other side of this coin. Understand? See what I mean?
Yeah.
Is it fair for a field press operator
paying
away $8 a day for a whole year?
What he is arguing is that the teacher's wage is more fair than the teacher's wage.
All right, now with that thought in mind, someone brought up the fact that I'm not a fed, but I'm looking at here. revenue to make the minimum. Now, where do you put the dollar sign there? I would say, just give them a living wage. Let them go to the Holy Land once in a while, less than 5 years.
Dedicated to teaching. Look, I've had this argument used, I've seen this argument used. Guy comes in to the president of the university and he says, you're paying me $7,000 a year. I have just gotten an offer for $9,500 in teaching. And the president says, I am shocked, son. I thought you were a dedicated man, dedicated to teaching. And now here it turns out you are greedy after filthy lucre. I saw a three-page letter. Said to a friend, it's their escape. Everybody nowadays, we must discuss this sometime, the pursuit of the dollar. Well, completely irrelevant. The guy was dedicated to teaching. The question was, should he teach at $7,000 a year or $9,500? And isn't there a presumption that if one school is willing to pay him $9,500, he must be worth about $9,500 to them. The other school is only willing to pay him $7,000, so he's only worth $7,000 to them. Where should a man work? I say he should work where he is most productive, where he adds the most to the welfare of society. And having no really good way of telling anything about that, I rely upon his wage. Thus, I would say, I will go teach where they offer me the most money on the assumption that where I'm offered the most money, I must be most productive. I know that's not true.
But it's certainly at the $7,000 level, and within your heart, you know that you can do a much better job in that school. Would you still go after the dollar sign?
No. Sir, but that isn't, that kind of situation is right. But you can never judge. You never know what's in
the mind. I'm not judging you, and I'm really going out.
Well, I just don't think it's fair to accuse teachers who are talking about stuff. I was wondering of not being dedicated. I don't care. I have different opinions about teaching. I think teaching is so much fun, well, at least college. It's not so much fun now. I'm not dedicated at all. I'm having fun. But nurses are a different matter. I think anybody, any nurse works in a hospital for anything less than $12,000 a year is dedicated. They're all dedicated. I have great respect for nurses, and I even allow them to be as crabby as they usually are. Now, who is this? We got to quit in a minute. Who is this? I think you were.
I was a big fan of the automation. The new hospital in St. Paul now is much more involved in automation. And where one is a circular plan, where one person can take 18 patients on a chart in front of a blood pressure, the whole business is all on a machinery.
Can be made to work. Listen, there have been some amazing things done just within the past year on labor economies in hospitals.
Thank you.
for the talking. We don't need RNs to talk to the patient. Do we hear we can have a division of function? No, you can have other people talking. Mm-hmm. No. I used to get along real well with the nurse's aide. What time do you have? 20 minutes. Do you have 20